Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Adam Nemeth, author of We Can Save Us All, his first novel, published just last month by the Unnamed Press. Adam is a graduate of Princeton, the setting of this book, and received his MFA from California College of the Arts. An excerpt of this book appeared in the Apocalypse Reader, which is a great book, by the way, and one you should pick up. We Can Save Us All is a kind of dystopian novel. Well, it is a dystopian novel, one that combines a coming disaster, or actually a series of them, and a band of almost former Princeton students that are self-named as superheroes, who live in a compound named The Egg. They attempt to ameliorate a coming disaster in which the world loses time in an increasingly rapid manner. This process is called chronostrictesis. And there are all kinds of coming climate change disasters as well. So those in The Egg, masterminded by this guy named Matthias, come up with a scheme that might stop or stop illusorily this wind down of time. Our narrator is David, a kind of nebbish, who still becomes a hero. And he also longs for a romance with Haley Roth, the love of his life, and also the heroine in this book. So in summary, this is a book that in a humorous, at times, but instructing manner, tries to show us the nature of men and women, especially young ones, as they deal with the possible end of the world as we know it, and remain calm and collected until the end. So welcome, Adam, and thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate being here.
You know, so why dystopia? And more importantly, why does everybody love dystopias? I mean, look at what I talked about, The Apocalypse Reader, and where I first read The Last Man. What is it so recently that, and your acknowledgments, you talk about them too. Why, and for me, they definitely are, why are dystopias so cool?
You know, I don't know if they're cool. I think it's an interesting thought experiment for a lot of us, and it's something that we do as humans somewhat naturally, is whether we do it consciously or subconsciously, this experiment of wondering what life would be like if blank, or, you know, it tends to be something that we're attracted to in terms of you know, popular entertainment, movies and things like that, maybe its own form of escape and a way of looking at our current world and saying, oh, I guess it's not that bad. But I think at best, and I think probably, the real reason, you know, deep down is that we're trained or maybe programmed, to imagine what the worst case scenario would be, specifically so that we take the steps needed to avoid it. I think there's something about, you know, wondering about the end of the world that makes at least a certain subset of the population, you know, do whatever it takes to hit that brake pedal and make sure that we don't go flying off the cliff. So in this case, you know, it's a particular thought experiment having to do with time, having to do with climate change. There's many others, and in my case, I think it's more of a pre-apocalyptic story as opposed to a post-apocalyptic story. It's preparing for this kind of slow slide into the end times, as opposed to, you know, looking at what life is like after some, you know, nuclear bomb is hit or after some tidal wave is hit. So hopefully it's a little bit closer to our current state of the world and to realism than some of the, you know, the Mad Max style apocalypse stories.
You know, and this kind of throws me off track of my questions, but I remember in your acknowledgments how you thank your mom and dad for the reversible Superman and Batman cape, and you just talked about suspension of disbelief, and I remember that passage in the book where David talks about, you know, this movie that would be a combination of the DC superheroes and the Marvel Cinematic Universe superheroes. And he's kind of obsessed. Well, the whole book is obsessed in a way with superheroes, from the costumes to the powers. So what made you go off on that track? And also in which he lists everybody from Thor to Guardians of the Galaxy. He lists all of them. And it's just interesting how you approached it, because it takes up a good portion of the theme of the book in the terms of superheroes, and it's something that you've always been interested in too.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people assume that because I wrote a book that features superheroes or superhero culture, that I was like a huge comic book guy growing up, and that's not actually the case. I have probably more graphic novels or comic books than some people, but that was never the thing that I really fell down the rabbit hole on. But I always was attracted to superheroes, you know, maybe in a more spiritual way, or a more, you know, there's a line in the book where David Fuffman, the main character, says, you know, my relationship to superheroes is mystical, not fundamentalist. And while I don't think that I am the main character in any stretch, I think the main character of the book makes a lot of decisions that I would never make, or is in a lot of situations that I've thankfully never been in. That one line does feel pretty autobiographical. I was always fascinated by the idea of superheroes in the sense of watching a character come into their own power. I think superheroes are interesting to me because of their origin stories more than anything else. I love the idea of watching a character go from ordinary to extraordinary, and really step into this role of, you know, I'm not just going to wait for someone else to help me out, or to save us, but I'm going to play an active role in that. And then, frankly, for me, it becomes a little bit less interesting after that, watching the battles and the, you know, who would win in a fight between Thor and the Hulk or something like that. That's a little bit less interesting to me unless it's done with, you know, with humor or with, you know, a new take on it. But that first part, the taking of accountability is really interesting to me. And I think that's what I was going for with the book, is that it's not just a single superhero or messiah figure that everyone is waiting on or turning to in this time of need. It's this organization that develops where everyone has to step up into that role or step into their power and figure out what it is about themselves that's either inborn or that they've learned or that they've fallen into accidentally, whatever it is that makes them special or that they can continue cultivating. That's the whole point of the organization that they find themselves in, is kind of taking personal accountability for the world and their small part of it, and trying to step into that personal individual power. Of course, it devolves into something a little darker, but, you know, at least that's the idealistic starting point for the characters in the book.
Well, you know, if you look at Matthias, you have this charismatic leader, and you can't help thinking about people like Charles Manson or Jim Jones, and behind them, you know, even though they're all authoritarian, nasty figures, there's something comic about the way they attempt to become who they are. What is it that gives the chief superhero, the charismatic leader, and you can compare him to authoritarian figures like Charles Manson or Jim Jones or whatever, but what gives them the power? I know it's their charisma, but what gives them the power to allow an entire populace to follow them? The majority, in this case, in the beginning, everybody, later on, the majority. What is it about that authoritarianism that gives them that ability?
Right. You know, I think unfortunately it's human nature. I don't think it's anything about that character or that, you know, figurehead necessarily. I think charisma plays a role and the time and place plays a role. But I think my fear, and I think what made me want to write this book in the first place, is that, you know, there's something about human nature that that makes us want to relinquish the accountability and the kind of the personal responsibility that we were just talking about. That, you know, especially in times of danger or times of fear, you want that messiah, father figure, or mother figure, that heroic person to step in and say, okay, I've got this, it's all going to be okay. You know, let's blame this other group of people or this other force, whatever it is, and I'm going to go to war with that thing, and I'm going to keep everyone safe, and y'all don't have to do anything but follow me. That seems to happen over and over again. It's happening right now in various parts of the world, including the United States. And, you know, when people feel like they're in danger, or, you know, maybe not even in danger, but just not doing as well as they think they should be doing, the tendency is for this charismatic figurehead to crop up and blame another group of people and then say, follow me and I'll take care of it. And we tend to say, okay, a lot of us tend to say, okay, great, good. Now I don't have to do anything. It's on, you know, all I have to do is follow and respect this one leader and get behind him, and everything will be okay for me.
Yeah.
And I think that's absolutely destructive and wrong and frightening as hell. But we keep doing it over and over again, as a species.
Yeah.
So I was trying to figure out why, I think, in the writing of this book over the last 12 years or so. And I think, you know, the way the organization starts is with sort of the antithesis of that it's not a single figurehead that's going to lead everyone to salvation. It's everyone individually stepping into that role of, you know, of doing something proactive and being on the front lines and putting themselves, you know, out there in a particular way. And then if everyone's doing that individually, this amazing collective will develop, you know, around that. But then, you know, as we tend to do, it starts to devolve and this one figurehead starts to emerge as the quote unquote leader, and everyone else becomes, you know, a follower and drops into the background and sort of blindly goes along with whatever crazy stuff they have in mind. And so I think both sides are hopefully represented in this book, the sort of roadmap of what it could be like if authoritarianism was not allowed to happen and we all took personal accountability, but then the cautionary tale of, you know, of that cult of personality developing and people, you know, falling into that trap again and again.
You know, since you mentioned, there's a couple of housekeeping questions I had. Since you mentioned working on the book for 12 years, more or less, what decided you to take a piece of what you call almost flash fiction in The Apocalypse Reader and turn it into, as you say, this long-ass novel?
Yeah. I mean, some of it was just this piece of flash fiction that you're referring to in The Apocalypse Reader, which was edited by a guy named, a great writer and great editor named Justin Taylor, who's written a bunch of novels and a collection of short stories called Flings. You know, he was kind enough to include me in this anthology that has some real heavy hitters in it, back when I was, you know, still in an MFA program. And I think part of it was just getting that first tiny little taste of publication or success or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, I had been writing for years before that, and this was the first thing really that I had published. And it was meaningful to me as a young writer, and still is. And, you know, I think part of me felt like, well, that, you know, that thing worked, and so let's just do that more and keep following that thread. And there's obviously something interesting enough in those three pages to make it into a actual printed pages. And maybe it was just Justin being nice to me, and, you know, including me as the good guy he is. But that was enough to kind of keep me interested in that on one level. I think, you know, on another level, it was just, I was fascinated by this premise that, you know, in the near future, you know, there could be some sort of apocalyptic phenomenon going on, and you have an authoritarian figure come to power in that. I think, you know, a big part of that piece of flash fiction was the drug use, that there was some sort of drug underlying that authoritarian's charisma or power, and some of that came from a documentary I had watched about Hitler and the copious number of drugs that Hitler was on for you know, a good portion of his reign. And you know, that was sort of the thought experiment that interested me and made it worth following. But I think a big part of it was just, you know, hoping that if this one little piece got published, maybe a bigger piece could get published someday.
Yeah, it was funny how the beginning of The Last Man starts with a Hitler thing, which is the very beginning of the book, and then it ends with the pills and the placebo making, which is kind of almost the end of the book. It's kind of weird how that happens. It's kind of like you filled in the whole middle, you know what I mean?
Right.
That's cool.
It only took me 12 years to fill in the middle.
Well, so another housekeeping one. How did you come up with the concept for the egg and you know, and why and how did they buy the houses on either side of them, and why did Colonel Blue keep allowing Matthias to take this money that he had in trust or whatever to spend all this stuff, you know, especially with the houses and the egg and all?
Yeah, you know, I think, well, you know, a few things there. I think one piece was that I lived off campus for about 2 years during college, which was something almost no one did. I know that that's a big part of campus life in some schools, and at Princeton, you know, nobody lived off campus, and we were definitely the weird ones in doing that. But I was working with a group of musicians, and we were at first kind of this improvisational band that then, you know, fell apart a little bit. But we ended up turning that energy into a nonprofit or a music organization that we had started at school called MEMA Music, and you know, there were events that we were throwing and, you know, concerts and parties and things like that. And then we ended up, the guys that I was living with in this house, you know, we ended up making a feature length film together about music called The Instrument, which came out in 2005. So part of it was just the experience of living off campus in a small, you know, it wasn't a geodesic dome. It was just a regular at a split-level house in Pennington, New Jersey. But that was a really kind of formative time for me. And to get off of the college campus a little bit and really go kind of deep with a group of people that seemed to kind of have similar interests in mind and be, you know, and then at the same time be really interested in what each other was passionate about. You know, I wasn't just a bunch of, like, writers living in the house. There was, you know, there was a chemist, there was a, you know, electrical engineer, there were different people doing different things. There was a guy who I'm still very good friends with who was creating artificially intelligent musical robots. And, you know, being around that energy for a couple of years was really fascinating to me. So that was part of it. You know, part of it was, you know, semi-autobiographical there. But we weren't, you know, developing anything nearly as crazy as what happens in the book.
Yeah, but, you know, your fascination with music, you know, I looked at that Tuning In with Adam Nemeth and your playlist, and then I read about you compiling for your kids, you know, this history of American music. It's obviously an enormous part of your life, separate from this, from the writing.
Yeah, it is. Music has always been a huge part of my life, and probably going back to going to concerts as a high school kid, going to Phish concerts or electronic music raves, anything I could kind of get my hands on there. There's a lot of ways to sort of roll your eyes at when you hear that and say, oh yeah, Phish shows, whatever. It was hugely important for me, and it was the sort of realization that these communities, these migrant traveling communities, exist where everyone just sort of took care of each other. I mean, I've been to probably 100 of these concerts now, and I've never seen a single fight or really even like altercation. Everyone's just sort of helping each other out in this very mutually beneficial way, and there's a real beauty to that. So it was something that I kind of fell in love with in high school, and then wanted to replicate as much as possible on campus, or at least expose people to on campus. And I think, there's something about music that does a little bit of what we talked about before, that, helps you kind of drop into something and see outside yourself a little bit. It's where, it's where I connect to a higher power in a little way. And it's hard to write about. It's hard, there's the great, yeah, I think Frank Zappa quote about, writing about music is like dancing about architecture. Huh. And, in college I had written this, this long, very long short story about musical ritual. And it was like describing each piece of music and the kinds of costumes that they were wearing and the kind of set that was there and all of this stuff. And I had the amazing fortune of working with Joyce Carol Oates at the time. And I think she said, maybe as a throwaway, like, you're writing about all this stuff. Don't you? It seems like you're trying to just create like a movie here, or like you want to hear the music. Maybe you should just go off and make the movie. And I took that maybe a little too seriously. And then we actually made the movie, and I had really no business doing that. I didn't know what I was doing at all, but it was an amazing experience. I think in this case, I think music is still a big part of this book. But I didn't want it to be the sole focus of it, because it's frankly just hard to, hard to render all of that in words in a way that's truly satisfying.
It's funny though, the book in its own way is kind of cinematic. I mean, as a reader, you really can follow the characters and have pictures of them and their suits and the egg and things like that. So it reads in an almost cinematic way. You probably get, maybe it'll be like The Martian, and you'll get optioned right away, and in 2 years it'll be starting.
That sounds great to me. I would be absolutely lying if I said I didn't. I didn't think in that, those sort of cinematic, terms when I was writing this. And I don't think it was writing with the idea of it getting optioned and becoming a film. But I think, in order to write, I have to really see what's going on and hear it and be kind of immersed in it, to the extent that I feel like when the writing's going well, I feel like I'm just kind of taking dictation and or transcribing what I'm seeing or what I'm hearing. And when it's not going well, when I feel like I'm sitting there saying, okay, well, what should this character say next? Or, what should they do? What should they do? Or what does this look like? That's when I feel like, I'm controlling it too much. But when it feels fully formed and I can see it and hear it and the characters are just sort of talking to each other, that's when it feels like there's real life in there.
Yeah, you could do a great soundtrack. It's like, the music definitely is semi-autobiographical, which brings me to another question, which is all the stuff about Thoreau, because I would think Thoreau has been a big influence here in life because he appears so often in the book.
Yeah, I think all of the transcendentalists, and I'm no expert on transcendentalism or anything, especially at certain formative periods of life, especially college, the transcendentalists were really fascinating to me. And again, it's one of those things that maybe some people would roll their eyes at now, that it's cliched or it's whatever. I don't care. I think it's interesting. And despite any you know, problematic aspects of the transcendentalist movement, I think what interests me about Thoreau and about all of that is the, you know, the humanism there. And I think that shows up in the book, the idea that it's not, you know, some higher power that's going to save us, or some, you know, some vengeful or benevolent godhead that's going to come down and rescue us from sin or from whatever. It's really, you know, it's that igniting of the human spirit that's going to have a real effect, that proactive, you know, approach to life. But, you know, but while also respecting the magic and the mystery that exists in nature and these things that we just don't understand fully yet, that's what attracted me to, you know, to Thoreau and to some of these transcendentalists. And then there's the real practical element of, you know, Thoreau kind of just going off into the woods and trying to live, you know, build this little shack in the woods and write and live an economical life, you know, a simple-ish life. And he wasn't, you know, some magnificent, I mean, he was living, you know, fairly close to, like, his parents' house and, you know, taking his laundry home on the weekends to do. And he wasn't any sort of perfect messiah figure either. I hope it doesn't come across like that. But I respect that he was the kind of person who wanted to do this experiment and then write about it. And, you know, it's someone who we're still reading about today, and there's a reason. And I think there's a lot of the other transcendentalists that kind of came at that from a different angle that's equally interesting to read about.
Yeah, there's kind of a juxtaposition. Although, like you said about him taking his laundry home, Matthias is kind of like that too. You know, there's a certain... Well, yeah, it's like stopping every 7 minutes and stopping for a minute. Those kinds of things are transcendental, but there is a juxtaposition in the way that Thoreau handled his life and the way that Matthias handled his. Like, for example, when you talk about going home and doing the laundry, and I don't want to give anything away, and I don't want to spoil it, but what is it about this idea? Let's see if I can do this right. What is it about the idea in life that parents can, especially these are 19-year-olds, that parents can just come back and rescue, that there's always this safety net of your parents, that if something goes horribly wrong, you can call them up, you can talk to them, or if it goes really bad, they can come and get you.
Yeah, well,
because that kind of surprised me in the book, actually.
That surprised you?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think, you know, and I tried to sort of hide this in certain ways, but then, like, on very occasional moments really hit the nail on the head that, you know, that's a safety net for some people. These are people that are extremely privileged and, you know, have lived a life of privilege in a lot of ways. And so at least some of the characters, you know, have these relationships with their parents where it is a safety net. And so, you know, which probably allows them to do these kinds of weird experiments at college and feel like, you know, at the end of the day, everything's going to be kind of okay. Or, you know, I still have my parents' credit card in my back pocket if I need it. That's not the reality for most people, you know, and there are instances in the book where, despite, you know, whatever financial or whatever, you know, socioeconomic setup one of these students has, you hear them talk about, you know, a fraught or, you know, difficult relationship with their parents where maybe it's not quite the same sort of safety net or just feeling of safety that parents are typically supposed to embody. And so I think I tried to hit both sides of that there are, you know, these relationships with your parents or with one's parents that do project an air of safety or that feeling like everything's going to be okay. Because, you know, they're somewhere in the background. But then in other situations, and I think Colonel Blue and his relationship with his son Matthias, you know, to the extent that it's in there, there's a safety net there in terms of money, maybe, but it's also really enabling and really problematic in a lot of ways, and it's probably the thing that, you know, the money there is what gets him into the most trouble, and he certainly, you know, doesn't come across as a protective figure through most of the book, the bits and pieces that he shows up. But I'm a parent now, and I think that's one of the main things that's changed over the last 12 years of writing, you know, going from writing this as a you know, 20-something MFA, you know, student to, you know, a father, a husband and a father now. I have a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old, and my feelings have I don't know if changed, but have evolved a lot over that period. And that feeling of, you know, fear or protection or wanting to protect, and maybe being able to, and maybe being unable to when the shit hits the fan, you know, the fear or the kind of vulnerability that comes with being a parent, it puts the idea of the student revolution or climate change or possible apocalypse, it puts all of that into kind of a different perspective, I think, when you become a parent. And it's not just, you know, I'm going to take responsibility for myself and, you know, put myself in whatever situation I feel like I want to be in. It's the you know, the loss of control that comes with having another little being that you're responsible for on one major level, but also, like, not fully in control of.
Well, you know, it's funny because I always like books where, you know, the reader has to decide for himself, and you're not led down this lane, and the end of the book is not wrapped up tightly and all that. And one of the pivotal scenes, maybe the pivotal scene, is when Colonel Blue comes into the egg and what he does and what David does. And the question for the reader is, and I still think about it, is whether Colonel Blue is a bad guy or a good guy. And,
yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, I kind of think, well, was he looking out for his son? Was he trying to stop? You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
Okay. And so I guess you had that in mind, because it is something that you have to think about, because it is indeed pivotal.
Yeah. Well, my hope here, or I think what I was trying to get at, is that I'm not sure if any character in this book is a good guy or a bad guy. You know, I think maybe all of them are both, or they're good at certain times and they're bad at other times, or something. But I'm not sure. You know, I really wanted to resist the urge in writing a superhero book that, you know, there was just some, like, pure evil, you know, pure evil type of villain, supervillain out there that they could all rail against and, you know, and battle, and that, you know, here are the good guys on this side and here are the bad guys on this side. I think it's more nuanced than that in real life, and hopefully some of that comes across in the book. But, you know, even our protagonist, our main character, you know, is the guy who's operationalizing this entire thing. And I think, you know, his intentions are good, and there's a lot of, you know, possible benefit that the USV can, that the core ideas of this group that they start, the unnamed super squadron of vigilantes, you know, there's some good ideas in there. And then there's some ways that those good ideas get really corrupted or twisted or, you know, used to, you know, nefarious ends. And I think that's religion in a nutshell to me, that there's, you know, there could be a lot of beauty and a lot of good baked into, you know, the ideas there. And then there's some not so great ideas that are, you know, either totally obsolete or downright dangerous or whatever. And, you know, what people choose to latch onto in the name of God or in the name of religion, I mean, that's responsible for way more deaths and destruction than climate change so far.
Hey, what's the deal with rowboats? Because in your acknowledgments, you say you're going to meet your wife by the rowboats, and then in the middle of the book, or towards the end of the book, you know, we have these rowboats that David's kind of, like, hauling around because of what's going on with the water. Was there any connection between the two of those? Because it seemed like they just popped out of nowhere, but it kind of made sense. But I wasn't sure whether you were kind of sending a message or not after I read the acknowledgments.
Yeah, you know, the one answer is just personal. Like, the, you know, my wife and I had sort of an inside joke about rowboats that did come from a, you know, ships in the night, rowboats in the morning type of thing that we had back in college when we met. You know, I was doing a lot of I was doing multiple thesis projects at the time, including that movie I mentioned. And when we were, you know, first dating and first getting together, it was hard to find time to hang out for a little while. And, you know, we used to joke that, you know, we were ships in the night, and, you know, then that turned into rowboats in the morning. We thought we were very clever. And so that's become, you know, that's continued to be a little bit of an inside joke between me and my wife for the last 15 years. But I think I made it part of the book because, a rowboat feels like a really, appropriate visual metaphor for a lot of this, you know, with climate change and flooding. You know, there's the ark, you know, there's Noah's Ark and kind of bringing everyone into this giant structure and, you know, keeping them safe from the flood. And then there's the rowboat, kind of the much more humble version of that, you know, where you're only able to put a few people in there. And it's something that I think, you know, it's part of what David's dealing with over the course of the book, whether it's possible to save all of humanity or whether it's possible to save everyone at Princeton or whether it's possible to save just the core group of people that he's closest with or whether it's just kind of his family and, or himself. And I think that's hopefully a metaphor or a symbol that shows up, through the book in a subtle way, but I'm glad you picked up on it. And then I think there's an element of Thoreau in there too. Thoreau would go take his rowboat onto Walden Pond, and there's an image. You know, that sort of image is somewhat romantic, I think, to people. And you know, this little craft, you know, out on the water.
You know, this is maybe, and to close this out too, because it's something we talked about before the show started, and it kind of to me, another question for the reader to ask himself or herself after he's done is the question whether we would be able to hold together. And I know you expressed an opinion when we were just chatting before, but what do you think would happen? And what you brought up, which is fascinating, and you know, you tend to forget on a day-to-day basis, is a lot of this is happening right now, and we're kind of letting it wash over us without really absorbing it. So what do you think is going to happen? Not if, but when we have these disasters that could or might tend to lead to the apocalypse.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't know. I'm very scared about it, but I'm also hopeful because I do think it's going to be a very local experience, and I think there's going to be certain localities or certain neighborhoods or houses or families, whatever it is, that are faced with that kind of reality. You know, that very, very different and uncomfortable reality, and can't handle it, and you know, for any number of reasons, for any number of very human, very understandable reasons, fall apart. And that's a very scary prospect, because I don't think, I mean, at least right now, I don't think, you know, our government is certainly not going to take care of us, in that way, in that kind of, you know, individual way. And that's not speculation. That's just looking at what you know, what's going on literally right now, like the last couple weeks, and the lack of, you know, useful response from the federal government. So I have no faith in that to save us, and I don't think anyone should. I think that'd be you know, really destructive to assume that, you know, it's going to be fine because, you know, our government will figure it out. I think it's going to come down to neighborhoods and communities, and, you know, maybe slightly larger, you know, regions than that. But it's going to be these these very localized responses. And, you know, are there people around you that you trust, and can you open yourself to that kind of trust? And, you know, I certainly don't have the kinds of skills personally that where I could, you know, put myself in a bunker or build a giant wall around my property and just, you know, live off the land for 10 years, keeping my family safe. At some point, pretty quickly, I would really need help from my neighbors, and I think they would need help from me. And it doesn't mean that we all need to know how to do these post-apocalyptic skills, or that we have to have these giant, you know, pantries of food that we then barter and fight over. I think, you know, it might just be a matter of like, you know, hey, can you help me, like, get a bunch of waterlogged stuff out of my basement, and then I'll help you fix your roof, you know? And I don't really know how to fix a roof, but I know enough, and I can teach you what I know, and you can teach me what you know. And, you know, eventually we all help each other enough. But I mean, on the mass grand scale, I think when the earth is done with us, she'll throw us off. But I don't see that happening in the sort of apocalyptic way that we all expect. I think it's going to be a real major shift in how we live day to day. And it's going to be a very uncomfortable shift. And either we can deal with that change and adapt, where we can't. And I think some people will be able to adapt and some won't. And I hope personally that I'm in the former category. And I think, you know, typically that's what happens, through history, is people are pretty adaptable. And so I have faith that we will continue to be.
Well, on that dystopian note, which is totally totally appropriate.
I don't know if that was hopeful or completely.
No, it was kind of like your book. So it's a great way to end the show. And I want to thank you, Adam, so much for coming here. It's a great book. And I didn't mention, but I have an independent bookstore, and it's sitting out front on our front table. And if you ever come by Chester County, which is a possibility, not a probability, stop in and say hello to us.
Well, thank you for having me on. Thank you for featuring the book in your store, and thank you for selling books and celebrating books. It's a wonderful thing, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for writing them, and thanks for being here. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot.
We were talking with Adam Nemeth, whose volume, We Can Save Us All, his first book, is published by an unnamed press, which doesn't sound like it's a press, but it is, the unnamed press. I think you get them in trouble sometimes because people wouldn't know it was actually published. But in any event, it's a dystopian novel. We talked about dystopias, but in some ways it's very hopeful, just like his last answer was. And, it was a really good book, and he, in his acknowledgments, you should take a look at those, because he talks about the people that he used, including his father, who's a great artist, and a great writer, too. So, in any event, I think it's a great read, and I think it's good to research a little about him and his family, he and his family. So, in any event, what do we have coming up? Oh, it's a really good book by Laura Adamczyk. It's called Hardly Children. And it's short stories, and I love short stories, and they're all really good. I've already read it. And then we're going to rebroadcast the National Book Award finalist, Tommy Orange, and his book, There, There, which has been sitting on the hardback bestseller list for weeks, months. So in any event, thanks as always, and we hope to see you back here next week on The Avid Reader.